Welcome back again to the On-Call Nightmares podcast. My name's Jay. I've been your host so far, and let me tell you, I've really enjoyed doing this podcast because it's given me an opportunity to meet a lot of people, have conversations with some that I really don't know if I've ever really would have gotten a chance to. And especially in such kind of like a manner where you can really dive in and ask some specific questions, and you're not, say, in a hallway track of a conference where, you know, there's a lot of noise around you. So getting the opportunity to really hear and understand some of the stories, ask some, you know, counterpoint questions on certain things has been really helpful, and I hope that you've learned from it, because I think I have. And that really is what this has all been about. It's just about learning, and I really do appreciate the response I've gotten so far. So thanks, everybody. If you'd like to be on the podcast and be in one of the interviewees, sure, give me an email. It's oncallnightmares@gmail.com. You can follow us on Twitter, oncallnightmare, and you can find me at jdestro on Twitter as well. So today's podcast is with Sam Phippen, and the interview that I did with him is going to focus on some incidents that he ran into at a place called DigitalOcean. Now he's with Google as a developer advocate, but he was an engineering manager prior to that, and he's got some really interesting stories that have to do with failure at a pretty large scale. Started by a very, very small thing, and it's a pretty interesting story, so I think you'll enjoy that. So rather than do a bunch of more blabbing, let's get right into it, and we'll hear from Sam. Welcome back to the On-Call Nightmares podcast. And once again, I'm going to bring you another conversation with a technologist who's been on call. And today, it's someone that I met recently. I knew of because of some of similar places that we had spent some time. But today we're going to speak with Sam Phippen. He is a developer advocate at Google, which is a pretty new role for him. So we're not going to bug him too much about what he's doing at Google, but we may poke him a bit about it. before that, he was an engineering manager at DigitalOcean. I got to spend a little time at DigitalOcean too. So I know some of the fires you've seen, but he's seen his own fair share of like deep and complex incidents and, you know, fires. And, you know, the cool thing is you have a lot of really interesting opinions around incident management and post-mortem culture and on-call. And it's really one of the things that I wanted to make sure I brought on to people that feel strong. So Sam, welcome to the podcast.
Thank you for having me.
No problem. So I want to talk to you a little bit first about just what you've been up to, maybe, say, the last couple years of your career, or maybe when was the last time that you were in an on-call position?
Yeah, so the last time I was in an on-call position was at the end of last year when I was working at DigitalOcean, and I joined DigitalOcean in April of 2016. So I got close to, but not quite, 3 full years of on-call experience working at that company. And then I'd been on call in previous roles, but that was the first time where I was working in like what you might call a serious production environment. Mm-hmm. And so like I would say that the overwhelming majority of my opinions and takes about how to do on call well were formed from things I saw at DigitalOcean, both good things and some not so good things for sure.
Gotcha. You want to give us a little brief introduction about some of your career, I guess, before DigitalOcean. How'd you get kind of started being on call? Was there a particular kind of role that they said to you, hey, guess what? You're part of the on call rotation.
Yeah, so before I worked at DigitalOcean, I actually was running a very small consultancy in London called Fun mm-hmm. and Plausible Solutions with a friend of mine, a guy named Ben Fields. And we had one or two clients that had absolutely no technical capability at all. And so like sure. when stuff was not working, we were really the only people they could call. And so while it wasn't anywhere near as formal as like, you know, here's a pager duty rotation. This is your responsibility. Like, you know, we were effectively the last line of defense, and we
looked like, down. We need you. We need you. We need you.
Right. Right. Exactly. And you know, we started out having no formal structure around that, and started to formalize it slightly more with our clients. But yeah, and those, I mean, those were really small operations. You know, of the form like a single Heroku dyno or a couple of Heroku dynos and a Heroku database, or like a small infrastructure configuration of our own on a cloud hosting provider, but like by no means with a big complex microservices distributed, any of that stuff really.
Yeah. I, in the past I worked for a consultancy where we had, you know, small customers that basically were friend of maybe the owner, and you're essentially providing a full suite of services, things that you wouldn't even think, like when they call you up and say, you know, so-and-so forgot to correct the file and we need you to go in with Vim and modify it live on the machine. So yep. I've been there.
Yeah. It's been a long time since I've, you know, FTP'd a PHP file to production, mm-hmm. but yeah, I know that gig for sure.
Yeah, that's the interesting thing. And I think that a lot of people who may be part of the way that ops was done for a very long time remember how simple protocols really were the deployment method. And now that we work with protocol, or I should say processes over protocols to deliver. So we mm-hmm. don't say, oh yeah, we got to make sure it's FTP'd up. Now let's make sure that you've committed it to Git. It's gone through CI/CD. So it's just amazing to think about what's changed, at least from my perspective. You could tell me if you've seen deployments changed, but I definitely have not put anything into prod over for a customer via FTP in quite a while.
So actually, like I literally saw this change as I was working at DigitalOcean. So when I joined DigitalOcean, it was still nodes under configuration management. And actually, I think just before we get too far into this, I should also say I no longer work for DigitalOcean. None of this is their opinion. This is all my opinion, but and I'm allowed to sort of share this stuff. But like, this is just the sort of disclaimer that I figured I'd insert.
Sure.
And anything
that you say is alleged. It is not on the record. It is all alleged.
Yeah. But with that out of the way, like when I first joined DigitalOcean, servers were configured with Chef, and mm-hmm. New code was like deployed by once it was on master, like the Chef nodes would converge at some point in the future and pull that new code in, or if you needed to do it more quickly, you could do a Capistrano deploy. DigitalOcean was running a lot of Rails apps at the time, right? And that's your laptop SSHing into production nodes to deploy code. And we slowly moved to a like containerized and Kubernetesified deploy of nearly everything. So DigitalOcean maintains an internal container platform called DOCC, and nearly all internal like control plane applications are deployed on DOCC these days. And that's, you know, Docker containers, Kubernetes, a bunch of wrapping services around those. But it's like, it's a much cleaner deployment model because it's not like code goes from developer laptop directly to production. Like there's a nice intermediary step there.
Sure. And it sounds like we've gotten to the part where we can maybe get to the rules of the podcast, because we've started the part where we're talking about old jobs, and I definitely worked at DigitalOcean, so I don't want to incriminate myself. So I tell you, please do not incriminate yourself in the process of going through this conversation. Let's mm-hmm. not incriminate others. I mean, there are some people that you and I probably still know at DigitalOcean who are still doing great work there. And matter of fact, Daniel, who does marketing and stuff for them, really, uh-huh. really nice person. I want to make sure I stay on his good side. And of course, the third rule is help us learn
yep.
from whatever the incident may have been. So I personally definitely had at least one production impacting incident that occurred at DigitalOcean, and I don't feel comfortable talking about that today. Maybe another time. But I'd like to hear. You don't necessarily need to say something from Dio, but if you have an interesting story from being on call, I'd love to hear it.
Yeah, for sure. And so the one I always like to lean on, and this is one that was post-mortemed publicly, so I'm like kind of okay with talking about. I've in fact given talks about it in the past, is the time we dropped our production primary database, which is never a fun story. So at the time, way less of a microservices, like separated out database architecture, many things were running through this core primary database. And yeah, like essentially database drop occurs and DigitalOcean's control panel and API were unavailable for a period of 4 hours and 56 minutes, according to the public postmortem.
Mm-hmm. Oof. And as somebody providing what are production servers, that 4 hours and 50 some minutes can really take a toll on you as an individual, yeah. Especially around, like, say, I want to call it alert, the alert stress that you end up having.
So I think it's worth noting, right, just to separate this out a little bit, that because of the way DigitalOcean is architected, this only affects the control plane and not droplets, mm-hmm. right? So, like, a user's servers do not can't become unavailable when this happens. Like a user's network does not become unavailable. So the control plane is everything that manages state changes to a user's account, right? And that includes creation of droplets, destruction of droplets, resizes, that sort of thing. So during this period of time, a user would not have been able to affect any of the resources on their account, but would have been able to like continue to access their servers. And so like
So either via like a process that sends it over HTTPS or a direct call from the control panel, essentially, nothing's being sent to the database, thereby nothing's able to be produced as a new or change. So I think that's okay.
Yeah, exactly. But so like one of the it's like an okay thing, right? So actually, just to maybe dig into sort of the timeline of this incident a little bit, right? What happened is like your database gets dropped, and then within about a minute, someone in Slack is like, "Hey, our service is saying the table DigitalOcean.users doesn't exist. What's going on?" And within and again, I'm quoting entirely from DigitalOcean's public postmortem here.
Sure.
And then 3 minutes later, it's like verified that the production database is destroyed. And that's, you know, that's the point where everything, like everyone in the entire company springs into action. Like, I think one of the things that was remarkable about my time at DigitalOcean is how good incident response practice in the early phases is. So DigitalOcean has a team called CloudOps. CloudOps is a 24/7/365 operations team. I like to describe them as like the best Linux sysadmins in the world.
I've met some of them in the past. Sorry to interrupt, but I've known some of those people. I've met some of those people in the past, and I can say that they are definitely hardworking individuals who really, really believe that you've got to be technically capable and understand what the environment is like.
Yeah, and just to maybe deviate down CloudOps a little bit, right? So, so the function of that group is to sort of help triage incidents from support, evaluate how severe they are, find the right team to page. You know, bring engineers in to help with incidents and that sort of thing. Now, this one is about as bad as you can get, right? Like dropping the database that manages your control plane for DigitalOcean. Like I don't have to tell you what happened internally for most engineers to be able to work out that's really bad, right? The database is your core provider for most of your applications, and like very, very quickly, you know, basically the entire control plane is down. But like they're there like a champ, like, all right, let's bring in everyone that we could possibly need to do this. And
so was it about recovery of the existing database and kind of handling the failures that are happening on, say, nodes?
So I'm really glad you asked that question, because there are a couple of defenses that DigitalOcean kind of has in place to deal with this. So the first one is that there's a 3-hour delayed replica of the primary database, right? So for the folks at home, right, we don't DigitalOcean, in fact, no reasonable operations company just has one copy of their database, right? They have multiple hot copies, usually replicating for reads, right? But also so that if your primary disappears for any reason, like, you can fail over to one of those read replicas and hopefully everything will work just fine.
Well, I always use the term delayed secondary is what I always call those.
Right. So in addition to like hot up-to-date secondaries, there's what's called a time delayed secondary. And so basically databases, you know, they maintain a log of every transaction that's being committed. And there was a 3-hour delay replica available to DigitalOcean. So basically at that point, right, you shut down everything. You turn off log streaming. The database team begins a strategy wherein you sort of play the 3-hour delayed replica back up to the transaction committed immediately before the drop, start imaging the database, compress the database image, transfer across the network, decompress the database image, restore the database image, and then bring all the servers back online, right? Mm-hmm. And actually, what took the majority of the 4-hour and 56 downtime was just moving the ginormous database image across the network, right? So actually, DigitalOcean now has significantly better networking hardware than it had at the time. And so, like, this probably would have been, like, a significantly shorter outage on today's hardware, which is great. But yeah, like, the thing that was really interesting here is how this happened. And, like, I don't know if you have any questions about that timeline, but
I was going to say, now I can start by asking, was it a fat finger, which is the typical human response to a dropping of a table? However, there's another particular assumption that I'll make, and I did read the postmortem back when it happened, so you'll have to, but I don't recall it all, but would I be right by saying that it could be new user with wrong environment set up in what they were working on?
So I'm trying to decide exactly what to say here. So the basic high level TLDR is that it's actually really funny because it was somebody on the team that I was the technology lead for who caused this to happen. So like I was right there. Actually, as a sort of funny aside, when this happened, I was grabbed by a couple of members of our security team because it was a credential my team was responsible for. And they were like, we need to check that nobody on your team got popped and that this credential is still secure because we don't want this to happen again. Like the security team was actively assuming this was an outside attacker. It turned out not to be an outside attacker, right? But like, that's a really good position for them to start from in case they have to shut down everything. But sure. So basically, what had actually happened is that we were building this internal application that, for various reasons, was really hard to test in isolation. But because it was a Rails app, you could just drop the production primary database string into like database.yaml and connect directly to the primary. So basically what happened is,
All good intentions start with a paste of something in prod. I understand. Yeah. Please continue.
And so basically, right, engineer is doing some local Rails testing against the production database, goes home for the day, comes in the next day, and then what's the very first thing you do every morning when you start writing software? You like run the test suite of your application. Without having changed the production credential, the very first thing the testing framework did is drop the database it's connected to create an isolated environment. And so, what we have here is a developer laptop connecting directly to a production primary database, that person having forgotten that they connected their development environment to that and then dropping it. So, like, it's not really a fat finger, right? Like, it's more like a sort of series of unintentional accidents. And I think this is where, like, I will insert my first piece of, like, incident management, like, philosophy, is that, like, no individual human is ever to blame for, like, an incident, or at least unless they were being deliberately malicious, right?
Yeah, and, like, and absolutely, because in this particular incident that you're kind of bringing up, I think it's fairly obvious that this person should have never been able to have direct drop access, and that's an institutional issue. And that's what I think, right, that I really like about modern DevOps and SRE, just to kind of get into some concept and theory for a second, is that modern DevOps and SRE says that you should never put an individual in that position. You should set people up to succeed, not fail, by ensuring there's enough layers of security and abstraction and checks to ensure that no one single person can take down the business.
Yeah, so this is where I'll sort of take off my insider knowledge hat and sort of like throw out, like, what I would consider, like, the baseline analytical questions that you should ask on something like. So
here's the what we learned from this outage portion of the podcast.
Sure, I might call it. If this were to happen again, here's all the questions I would ask, and that most of them are fairly obvious, right? So the first thing I'll say is that when I think about really big, serious production incidents, it's always, so I break it down by systems, procedural, policy, and training issues, right? Mm-hmm. Like, these are sort of the four big buckets that I like to use. And so to me, like, there are a bunch of questions like, well, you know, technical questions like, how on earth is it that a developer laptop without elevated access can connect to the production primary? Mm-hmm. Why does a random application credential have the ability to drop the production primary? Like, you know, why is it easy for the developer to get their hands on this credential in the first place? Why are there not alternate read-only credentials of it? You know, a bunch of questions down that, but those are all technical. But I'm sort of more interested in wider questions, like, why was it difficult for this person to test the software they were writing without making these connections in the first place? And to me, that's like, mm-hmm. that's like a much more interesting line of questioning, right?
How do you set someone up to succeed instead of fail through process?
Right, exactly. Because, like, this all comes down to a degree of robustness of production processes, right? And, like, mm-hmm. is it a lack of available staging environments? Is there no ephemeral staging environment? Is the staging environment an inaccurate replication of production? Well, that's always true, but the question is, like, how inaccurate is it, and can you make it accurate enough? Is it easy for us to create stubs that would have replaced this? Like, you know, questions down that line. And, like, how can we, basically, I guess, yes, you've sort of you nailed it on the head. It's like, how can we make it easy to do the right thing and hard to do the wrong thing? Because I can tell you that, like, that pasting that production credential in was the only way that person could have achieved the thing they were trying to achieve at the time. And, like, that's not, like, there's so many questions to ask there. And, like, honestly, the sort of inside response from DO was like a big swarm around how can we make this basically impossible for it ever to happen again, right? And, like, mm-hmm. I feel pretty comfortable in saying that the place that they're at now and the work that the database team at that company has done is really incredible, and it would be very difficult for something like this to happen again at this point. Yeah, like, DigitalOcean really does have a great team of database engineers making sure that mm-hmm. everything is working robustly. Like, truly some of the most hardcore ride or die folks I've ever seen operate a MySQL database.
Yeah, and that's the interesting part, is that is a MySQL database. It's something that's open source. It's something that doesn't come with any sort of, like, specific vendor lock-in or anything like that.
Right.
You are dealing with technology that you have the ability to also modify for what your business wants to do. And that's one of the things that, you know, you look at companies like Percona that have come out and put out really heavily modified versions to include, you know, more efficiency and better speed or this.
Yep.
Or that. And it's interesting. So, it's always great to also tell people that the companies that are building what I think are the modern internet are still using the same tools that we've been building things with, like MySQL, for a very, very long time. And I think that's one of the really interesting parts to kind of get people just a tiny look underneath the hood of that particular company, is that even for, you know, big engineering departments, small mistakes happen also.
And yeah, absolutely. Well, it has to be like a perfect chain of, it's always like a perfect chain of failures, right? Like, I would say in nearly every incident I've seen that's not like bug made it, like bug that was recently authored made it to production, mm-hmm. like something that's like some composition of things that have been around for a while, like it's always really important to me to dig in like a lot of different directions to try and understand how the thing that happened, right?
Sure.
So like when I'm post-morteming an incident, I will spend like a lot of time gathering just facts and data points from all of the various systems that are available, right? Mm-hmm. GitHub, Slack, monitoring systems, logging systems, exception tracking, and like try to build a coherent picture of what actually happened. And I think a lot of people want to jump directly into analysis. And in fact, I've actually made the mistake of missing certain pieces of like factual information and then analyzing an incident and coming up with what I believe are solutions and discovering that they actually are not the right answer. And so that's
paying more attention to the drop of the table rather than the actual like way to prevent it and how it happened. Is it kind of that kind of thing?
Well, I was more talking in generalities there. So like, but yeah, like in this case, like you need to know every step in that chain to be able to come mm-hmm. up with a decent analysis. It's not just like developer accidentally ran the test suite with a production credential, right? Like even that isn't deep enough, right? It's like
Yeah. We
were doing some testing on this thing and it was hard to test locally. So we can, right? Like all of those are important pieces of factual information that go beyond, right, just like this developer dropped this table.
So a postmortem has a story, and that story has layers that you need to be able to get through in order to actually find what happened.
Yeah, so about a year ago now, I gave a talk at Garuco about what makes a really good postmortem, and I sort of spoke to what I call the timeline section. And the timeline is this fact pattern that I'm talking about. And basically what you want to do in your timeline section in your postmortem is analyze what happened, or actually analyze is the wrong word. Gather information about what happened devoid of any like analysis or emotion, right? So like, user did this, user ran deploy at this point in time, this code went out to production, these servers rolled over, like error rate increased over here. Like it's referencing factual material. And the reason that you want to do that.
And it's also very important in this process to understand bias and what your existing biases are, and to be able to identify whether or not you carry a bias when you're gathering that information.
Yeah, exactly. And so like, The places where you gather information tend to be organization specific, but it's like it's not just like Slack, and it's not just your monitoring system, and it's not just GitHub, right? Right. It's like anything that you can demonstrate to be tangentially related is probably useful and important, right? And then like what you have there is like a from beginning to end fact pattern of what I should also perhaps insert here, that like this will start long before you noticed your incident sometimes, right? Like to use a straw example, like if you have a server whose disk fills up, right, which is not really a thing anymore, but like let's just use this as an example, right? Like like that might start hours or days before like the disk actually filled, right? And so your incident timeline doesn't start when like you call an incident. Your incident timeline starts like whenever the condition that caused the incident to eventually happen started, right? And that could be days or weeks before. And in fact, I've postmortemed incidents where the window has been so wide that that information has rolled out the end of like the centralized logging store I was using. And those are like really annoying because you're like, we can't exactly determine when this happened, but we think it might have been around like here. Right. Mm-hmm. And so, like that information degrades over time. And so it's also really important to capture that information as quickly as you possibly can. Right. But like the point of just getting the information is so that like other engineers in your company can take a look at that and come to their own analyses and conclusions before taking mm-hmm. a look at yours. Right. I think when people write postmortems in general, they don't go far enough into doing like wide systemic analyses as to why these problems occurred. And at least to some degree, part of the reason for that is that the term root cause is incredibly misleading. It implies that there's one, and it implies mm-hmm. that like you can get to it easily. When most real complex incidents are like a confluence of different things, break down into people, process, systemic, training factors, and like there are often multiple, right? Like I'm a big fan of reading like FAA incident reports to show to just like the depth and complexity of detail they go into and use them as like a shiny example. I actually gave a talk about this incident, the database incident, and a plane crash simultaneously a while ago. And I think that is a really good illustration. It's called Runway Overrun, if people want to like dig further into my like conversations about incidents, for sure.
Sure. Cool. So it sounds like we've learned a lot.
Oh, but yeah.
I want to start kind of rolling things up for us here. And I really want to know if someone is listening right now and they're currently on call, what's a piece of advice that you'd like to give to this person?
That's interesting. I feel like the best piece of specific advice I've ever given to like individual contributor responders is like just communicate more. So like incidents live or die based on how well the person dealing with the incident communicates what is happening.
Sure.
So when I've been managing incidents before, I've been very frustrated when an individual declares they're going to go away and do something and then like doesn't communicate for 5 or 10 minutes about what the status of their thing is doing. And even if it's I'm still doing X, it's like really helpful to, if you're incident commander, to know the state of all of those things.
Sure.
I will say that most of my on-call advice is aimed squarely at like the engineering managers, directors, and VPs of the world, and I have boundless takes. I think you invited
me on. So let's give that manager who might be listening one specific piece of advice that you think could really help them help their team get more sleep.
Yep. I think the biggest one I tried to enforce when I was managing my previous team at DigitalOcean was if you get paged more than like 2 or 3 times in a week, you are getting rotated out and the next person who's on call is like taking your stead, right? Gotcha. Or I'm taking your stead. And the reason there is that like out of hours pages are brutal. They wear people down. They hurt. Like, and so I think doing enforced or like automatic rotations as a part of on-call policy is a really good idea. It's
very about your people.
Yeah, it's very easy to say like I will ask you if you want to rotate after you've been paged a certain number of times, but certain people will say no and certain people will say yes, right? And so a way to make it more fair is to make it automatic instead of like up to the determination of the person who's on call.
Well, great. So, Sam, I want to kind of roll us into the end. And that being said, I want to get all the information out there so people who may want to talk to you and kind of continue these conversations will be able to.
Uh-huh.
So I know you have a website. It's samphippen.com, spelled samphippen.com. I imagine you have some blogs and stuff like that.
Yeah, so that's my blog. It contains two of three parts of my, like, epic tirade about how to do on-call correct. So I think you invited me onto this podcast after I published my first 3,000-word blog post about on-call, and then I published another 3,000-word blog post about on-call, and then I'm nearly done with the final one. Yeah, so, like, that...
Well, maybe we could talk and get this coordinated at the same time. We'll see. We'll see how that works when we finish hitting the record button here.
Yeah. So that series can be essentially summarized as a snapshot of my thinking about how on-call should function as I wind down into a job role where I'm unlikely to have any on-call responsibilities. And it's kind of, in some ways, it's a note to myself when I probably in the future end up back in that position, or certainly more likely with the power to influence others in on-call, how, like, what my value system is. Sure. That's like a secret motivation for why I wrote that series.
So making sure that on-call isn't simply about making sure systems are reliable, but it produces value to the business that doesn't burn out individuals.
Yeah, well, I think most people are too focused on the on-call part of incident management, actually. Mm-hmm. To me, I see incident management as a holistic practice that on-call is a part of. And, like,
sure,
there are so many other things that you have to consider for on-call not to be terrible. And so, like, I try very hard not to talk about on-call as a thing in isolation. I try to talk about incident management as a holistic process.
Gotcha. Well, you know, that's really great stuff, and I do appreciate you sharing it with us. So that's going to kind of bring us to the end of our conversation. If you'd like to continue, like I said, talking to Sam, you can also find him on Twitter. It's at Sam Phippen. If possible, we're going to find some cats for you to hug, because I've heard that you're trying to hug all of them. And I want to help you meet your goal.
Fantastic. If I might just plug one last thing, sure, I also have my own podcast. It's called The Yak Shave. You can find us at yakshave.fm or at @_yakshave on Twitter.
Awesome. Well, thank you very much. And we will be back in just a second to wrap up this episode. Thanks again for being part of it, Sam. I really appreciate it.
Perfect. Thank you.
Cool. All right. We'll be right back.
Well, that was really great. Thanks a lot, Sam, for that interview. I really enjoyed hearing that story, and I hope you did too. It was pretty terrifying to think about how much actual downtime can really impact so many people, but how those people can really come together and build a smart resolution and a decision on how it'll never happen again. And that's really what it's all about, is finding out how these problems that we run into don't happen again. So thanks a lot for telling the story, Sam. And we will be back next week with another great interview with another member of the tech industry who's been on call. And if you'd like to be interviewed, just get at me at OnCallNightmare on Twitter or at JDestro, or you can just email. It's OnCallNightmares@gmail.com. We'll talk to you next time. Hope your alerts are all green and everything stays online for you, or at least at 99.999% of it. We'll see you next time. Bye-bye.